I invite you tonight to turn in your Bibles to the book of Exodus, chapter 2. Exodus, chapter 2. While the phrase, happily ever after, may fit very well at the end of most fairy tales, it's hardly an accurate description of the Christian life. The life of a child of God is real. It's not made of plastic or stained glass. It's not consist of sugary sweet sentimentalism. Instead, it oftentimes involves affliction and loss, disappointment and setback, failure and often deep pain. And yet, through it all, there can also be joy and hope, even in the midst of that heartache and tears. But in our product-oriented culture, many today are looking to package faith in a slick, shrink-wrapped version that's nothing but happiness and peace. But we understand that's not real. That's just a cheap imitation of the genuine article. That pain is an essential element of growth. And no one demonstrates that to us more than Moses. If there was an actual school of hard knocks, Moses would have held a PhD, actually perhaps more than one. As a child, you remember he was adopted into the wealthiest family of all Egypt. According to Stephen in Acts 7 and verse 22, he was educated in the learning of the Egyptians. He would have attended the very best of schools and no doubt received a number of advanced degrees. The Jewish historian Josephus also tells us of an account that while Moses was still in his early manhood, that Egypt was invaded by Ethiopia and threatened one of their most important cities, the cities of Memphis, and that Moses was entrusted with the command of the royal troops. He immediately went into battle against the Ethiopians and soundly defeated them. And so Moses was more than just a royal student. He was a soldier. He was a statesman. Again, quoting from Stephen in Acts 7 and verse 22, that he was a man of power in words and deeds. And what all of that translated to mean was that by virtue of his education and his military experience and his membership in Pharaoh's household, that he was the most logical choice to one day be Pharaoh himself. And yet all of that changed within the course of a day or two. Exodus 2, beginning in verse 11. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that. And when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" But he said, Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you did the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely this matter has become known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Where most people are trying to get to the top of the pyramid, understand that Moses was in line to own all of the pyramids. And then with one impulsive act, Moses goes from the very top to the absolute bottom. At the age of 39, Moses had it all. He had power and prestige. He had education and wealth. A career in which the sky was the limit. By any worldly standard, Moses stood among the most successful men in the entire world. When we think about Moses, we either tend to think of him as an infant that was set adrift by his mother on the Nile River, or we think about the Moses connected to the plagues and the Red Sea and all of the marvelous things that he did as the leader of Israel. And certainly while the account of his infancy and his rise to power that occurred during the first 40 years of his life and the plagues and the Red Sea and his leadership that occurred during the last 40 years of his life, though those were very important segments in Moses' life, oftentimes we overlook the middle 40 years of his life that really is covered in just, 10 or 15 verses. And to do so, it really is really is to make a grave mistake. Because it's this middle section of Moses' life in which God performs some of his greatest work, especially in this man's life. It was a time of great learning and training for a task that would ultimately await Moses. It was a time, however, that was marked in Moses' mind as a time of great pain and very deep soul searching. That at the age of 40, Moses goes back to school. But the classes that he is going to take will not be like anything that he took when he went to the Egyptian university. He's received his BA and his MBA and his PhDs, but he's about to earn the toughest degree of all. For the first 40 years of Moses' life, he stands as an unrivaled success. During the next 40 years of his life, he will be an undisputed failure. But it is that second period of 40 years that prepares him for the final 40 years of his life when he will be a tool wonderfully fit for the master's hand. There are some things that if Moses, as he sat by this well, that surely must have went through his mind, lessons that he learned in this initial experience. And one of those surely had to be that spiritual ends are not achieved by carnal means. Stephen again provides us with some insight into what was going on in the mind of Moses when he stepped forward to defend his Jewish brother, that there was more in his mind at that moment than simply defending a helpless slave. Quoting from Stephen, Acts 7 in verse 24 and 25, when he, that is Moses, saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him. But they did not understand. What Stephen tells us is that around 40 years of age, it had become clear to Moses that God had chosen him to be the deliverer of Israel. He hit the nail right on the head in regard to the task, but he was dead wrong in regard to the method. When Moses killed the Egyptian, he believed that he was following God's plan, and yet in the text that we read, there's no record of that Moses ever prayed before he administered the blow. No hint that he ever sought the will of God before he took that significant step. Instead, what Moses himself writes is that he looked this way and he looked that way, but he never looked that way. He never looked up. What he believed would propel him to a place of leadership would become the biggest setback in his life. The bottom falls out of his life the bottom of a wet cardboard box. The simple fact is that you can't sow fleshly seeds and grow spiritual plants. You can't plant carnality and reap godly fruit. You can manipulate and you can connive, you can scheme and you can plot your way to the top. But when you get there, don't thank God for the promotion, because your fingerprints are on it, not his. You can cheat on an exam and you can get a good grade, but don't thank God for the A. You can fudge on your income taxes and get a large refund, but don't give God the credit for blessing you with the extra cash. God's plan was not for Moses to kill a man and bury him in a shallow grave. That was Moses' plan, and it was carnal from start to finish. You think about what Moses is attempting to pull off here. His goal is to take several hundred thousand slave laborers, along with their wives and their children, and lead them out of Egypt and back to the land of their fathers. Moses believes at 40 years of age that they will follow his lead, that they will rebel against Egypt, and that somehow they are going to be able to obtain their freedom under his leadership. And what all of that reveals to us about Moses by the time he's 40 years of age is that he is a man who is marked by a high degree of self-esteem, great self-confidence, tremendous courage. He believes in himself. He trusts that he has what it takes to pull off the Exodus. After all, Moses was a mover and a shaker. He was a leader with a capital L in Egypt. He expected to be successful in this venture just like he had been successful in every other venture in his life.
But this time it didn't work out, did it?
There's a kind of self-esteem, a kind of self-confidence that's healthy and good, and then there's an excessive brand that's detrimental to one's spiritual well-being. How do you tell the difference? Well, an unhealthy self-confidence is busy instituting our own plan, following our own instincts, leading our own way, believing that it's going to work out exactly as we have it planned without ever stopping to look up. Understand this important principle. Moses was not looking to go against God's plan here. He just failed to consult him. He didn't sense his dependence upon God's guidance and God's direction to pull this off. And that's why Moses' failure had to have been especially bitter for him, because he genuinely believes at the age of 40 that God has put him in a position of power and authority for the purpose of securing the release of the children of Israel, and he's right with that. And as he sits down by the well, he realizes there's nobody else in the pipeline. There's no one else with the influence that he wielded in Egypt. There's no one else looming on the horizon to help the children of Israel. He was it. Or at least he used to be it. And now the people's one opportunity for freedom is over. And if you didn't realize that when he took the life of the Egyptian, it was certainly reinforced on the following day when he tries to take the reins of leadership as the two Hebrews are fighting among themselves. At that moment in time, he now understands that his entire plan is coming apart at the seams. He supposed his brethren would understand. And now he sits by a well in the land of Midian, and he realizes that spiritual means are not achieved by carnal, or spiritual ends are not achieved by carnal means. And surely he also learned that timing is as important as action, sometimes more so. You've done it, I've done it. We've done the right thing, we didn't do it at the right time. And the whole thing blew up in our face. The truth is that God not only plans what we are to do, but he arranges the right time for us to do it as well. As Moses sits by the well in Midian pondering the event with the Egyptian taskmaster, he may have rehearsed over and over again in his mind that he had acted prematurely, that he tried to make something happen, that he tried to force his way in, and everything backfired on him. That instead of laying the matter before God and allowing God to close or open the right doors, allow God to put the right timing in place, Moses just instead chose to forge on ahead. Knowledge may tell us what to do. It's wisdom that tells us when to do it and how to go about carrying it out. One wise man said that one blow struck when the time is right is worth 1,000 struck in premature eagerness. And we've all been there, haven't we? Frustrated because things aren't happening as quickly as we would like. And we ask ourselves why God seems to be chugging along in first gear when it's our conviction that things need to be kicked into overdrive. The problem, however, is that not that God is too slow. It's just that we're wanting things to happen too fast. Or at least too fast for our own good. You ever seen somebody walking an untrained dog? They got him on the leash. It's straining at the tether. Its eyes are bulging out. Its tongue's dangling out. It's tugging here and there. It's panting and it's wheezing as half of its windpipe is cut off with a choker chain. Does the fault lie with the guy at the other end of the leash? Is he, and the answer to that to some degree I suppose is yes. But is he cruel and unreasonable because he wants to walk instead of run off in all kinds of different directions? Or is it the fact that the dog needs to learn a couple of new concepts? Moses, in the first 40 years of his life, is too strong, he's too smart, he's too cultured, he's too gifted, he's too advantaged for his own good. He's the dog straining at the leash to run off in his own chosen direction. And what he needed to learn was that pacing himself and waiting for God's timing is not a sign of weakness, it's a mark of strength. That if we're like Moses, straining at the leash, gagging because of the collar, kicking up the dust of impatience, That if that's who we are, then we are destined for a life of utter frustration. Why? Because life moves at its own pace. God's pace. That no matter how much we might want something to happen now, circumstances don't conform themselves to our expectations or our time schedule. And if you try and force something to happen, I assure you that you are going to make matters only worse. And if you don't believe that, ask Moses. Third, as he sat by the well, surely he understood that hiding doesn't erase wrong, it merely postpones the inevitable. According to verse 12 there in Exodus chapter 2, Moses killed the Egyptian and he tried to hide the evidence in a shallow grave, and yet within 24 hours it was all over the news. The few inches of loose sand really hid nothing at all. The way one writer put it is this. He said that the most Adamic muscle in all of us, that is the muscle that reminds us the most of Adam, is what he referred to as the hiding muscle. It's a condition that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, and it has remained a classic reflex of the sinful human race ever since. Adam and Eve tried to hide themselves in the bushes, to cover themselves with the large fig leaves. Moses tries to cover things up with desert sand. And we look to cover things up, our actions of the flesh, our sinful attitudes, our bad habits. We even at times cover the truth about ourselves from ourselves, don't we? Mark Twain phrased it this way, that we're all like the moon, that we have a dark side we don't want anyone to see. Why? Because for us, image and appearance are of much greater importance than authenticity. And yet, as Moses himself would later write in Numbers chapter 32 and verse 23, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Moses had some experience with that, didn't he? Fourth, I think he would have understood that spiritual leadership is not self-assumed. It's divinely appointed. Do you understand how foreign that concept is in our secular world? You get your job, you get your promotion by coming up with a stellar resume that pushes the edge of embellishment in regard to your experience and your accomplishments. We're told to exude a total confidence that we're capable of handling anything. But that's not the way that it is among the people of God. Moses didn't understand that, but he will. He had earned his degree at Sun Temple University or something along like that. It is believed that there was a university very close to the temple to the sun god,
and he may well have attended there and been an alum,
that he earned that degree, that the military stripes on his uniform he received because of a distinguished military career. It was only a matter of time until he becomes promoted to the position of Pharaoh, and with those kind of accomplishments under his belt and so promising in regard to the future, then surely jumpstarting a revolution among the Jews seemed well within his range of competence. And so he thought he could just go out and do it. But he failed miserably.
When it comes to spiritual leadership,
business acumen may actually be a detriment. Financially successful people, movers and shakers, people who have conquered things and achieved much in their life, may actually be horrible leaders in a local assembly. Saul looked on every part that of a leader, didn't he? He was the tallest guy, the handsomest guy, the most courageous guy. And though he had a decent beginning, he turns out to be a pathetic, self-motivated monarch. And yet the guy who doesn't look at all like a king, a teenage shepherd boy by the name of David, ultimately proves to be Israel's greatest ruler. You read through 1 Timothy, Titus chapter 1, and what you see is that God's leaders look very different from their secular counterparts. And Moses has to learn that lesson the hard way, by way of his own personal failure. Now, we know that Moses will learn this important lesson because 40 years later, God is going to appear to him at the burning bush. And though God at that moment has indeed chosen him to be Israel's leader, he is going to be convinced that God has the wrong guy. Moses may well have believed this last point a little too well.
But eventually the 80-year-old Moses would run himself out of excuses and with great reservation will take upon himself the role of deliverer. And I believe that in the back of Moses' mind, he felt like it wasn't going to work, but it did. Because God worked. And Moses became one of Israel's greatest leaders. But it didn't happen when he was at the age of 40. When he sought to assume that role of leadership on his own, it only occurred when he waited on God to appoint him to the task. And so the man who sits down at the well in Midian is a very different person from the guy who lived in Egypt. He's gone from the palace to the desert, from success to failure, from wealth to poverty, from significance to insignificance, from privilege to persecution, from freedom to being a felon, from possessing purpose in life to seemingly now having no purpose whatsoever, from having a great future to having a very grim future. And all of it happens within 48 hours. We've all heard stories of overnight successes. Well, Moses is a story of overnight failure. And it's in his mid-life that he loses everything. In the course of a couple days. And we mustn't miss that part of Moses' life. That as he sits down at a well in Midian, he is stunned and wounded. He is hurt and embarrassed. He is humiliated and he is confused. He has lost his career. He's lost his status. He's lost his privilege, his reputation, his family, his friends, his future. How would you feel if you were Moses sitting by the well? In Midian.
A man who had possessed such a high level of self-worth now sees it disappear without warning and in just a moment of time. But God's not done with him, is he? God hasn't shelved Moses forever. He's going to simply retool him. He's going to fashion Moses into the man that he wants Moses to be. And we see that in the next few verses. Look at verse 16 now. Exodus 2. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. Think about the scene there. Here is a former prince of Egypt watering animals. Why? Because he had just choked down a sizable portion of humble pie. And he's ready to do anything. He sees the 7 women oppressed and he seeks to be their deliverer on a much smaller scale than what he had tried to accomplish in Egypt, but a deliverer nonetheless. Again, just a day or two before this, he has been convinced that he was to deliver a nation. He had grand hopes, clever schemes. And now he has the opportunity to begin this transformation into God's type of leader by way of helping 7 women who need a champion. Understand, Moses at that moment could have just ignored the problem. He could have crawled into a hole somewhere and said, well, let somebody else do it. And even though it was just a small act of courage, we see him here taking the first step in becoming what he needs to be, and that is a man of selfless dedication. Look at verse 18 and 19 as the text continues. When they came, that is the seven daughters, when they came to Reuel their father, he said, why have you come back so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian, notice the term here, delivered us.
From the hand of the shepherds.
And what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock.
Matthew Henry, in his commentary,
said this of Moses.
He loved to be doing justice and appearing in the defense of such as he saw injured, which every man ought to do as far as it is in the power of his hand to do it. He, that is Moses, loved doing good. Wherever the providence of God casts us, we should desire and endeavor to be useful. And then Henry closes with this. And when we cannot do the good we would, we must be ready to do the good we can. That's Moses, isn't it? Few things humble a person like failure. And so what does a humble person do? Whatever the next task is. They do what they have the opportunity to do. And that's what Moses does. But understand, this is just a small step. Because God's training in this middle portion of Moses' life is not over yet. And we'll look at that part next week.